Earlier this week, I had a difficult conversation with someone very dear to me. We were having lunch, and I noted that she seemed distant and the conversation was hovering on the surface of pleasantry rather than swimming in the usual depths that our long-standing and much-cherished friendship privileges. When I inquired if something might be going on, I was met with a polite sort of, "Oh, let's talk about it some other time." And I pushed a little harder, saying, "No, tell me." And what came back at me was hurt. Feelings that were hurt because I hadn't been as present in our friendship as history would expect. And my friend, who is as much family and more than as anyone else, told me that it seemed hard to get on my calendar these days, that it would take me longer than usual to respond to a message or a missed call, and that even when we did get together, I seemed preoccupied. And I listened as carefully as and openly as I could, and I fessed up. All excuses of work's been really crazed, or studies have been intense, or we don't live in the same neighborhood anymore, or vacation schedules, or anything else, that didn't matter. Not to me then, not to her, and certainly not to us. The truth in that moment was that someone I love was hurt because I had been nowhere as close as I usually am. Now, the arc of our friendship is long and our future together is longer still, this much I pray, so I know the ship is rightable. There's actually not that much to figure out. As repair work goes, the remit here is pretty straightforward, at least on the surface. My friend loved me enough to tell me how my absence had been hurting her, and I love her enough to have first listened, and now to amend, to be more responsive, to follow my own heart and to reach out to her, to do the work of tending and caring and of showing up. But then it goes deeper, things generally do. And though there are certainly things I can do, there are also things I need to know. For me, accepting what another offers is sometimes so much more difficult than offering what I hope others will accept. And over the course of many, many years, of many cities, many dates, many adventures, many meals, many mishaps, our friendship has been an emotional bedrock for both of us. But in my absence, my friend worried that maybe I didn't need her anymore, that I somehow no longer needed her or the emotional support she has always offered. What is difficult and humbling for me to hear in that expression is that it wasn't just cheerful, optimistic, laughing Will that she missed. She also missed vulnerable, crying, feeling lost Will. My friend rightly felt that I had been absent, and in my place, fear and doubt were now here. Now, a long, long time ago, a far greater man than I sat alone in a cave, and he had been really busy of late. He was tired and worn down. Truth be told, he was feeling a little sorry for himself. And that's okay, we all do that from time to time. Elijah had been prophesizing and preaching and running from his enemies. He had survived a famine and a drought and had been up and down all over the northern and southern kingdoms. No one he knew was working as hard for God and for God's people as he was. Elijah felt that he was alone in his pursuit of heavenly things. This morning, we heard him describe himself as zealous. But if we were reading the King James Version, we would have heard him identify as jealous, both words expressing an extreme sort of attachment. And these are words that Elijah uses to describe himself. But they're also words that the prophets and the psalmists have used to describe God. In other words, there's a lot that connects Elijah and God. Their friendship is pretty tight, and they talk a lot. Now, up until this point in our ancient story, God has been a boisterous God. Historically, God has spoken in a big, loud voice. God speaks in earthquakes, fires, winds, and floods. Like the old Batman cartoons where every action is punctuated with a wow, kazow, or kabam. The voice of God in the dialogue between God and God's people has been mighty and righteous. This is an extroverted God, a loud God, a fighting God. And no one thought this was more awesome than Elijah. And no one tried harder than Elijah to emulate this God and to fight for God's plan with a similar zealousness. But Lord, such thunder can be exhausting. We know it was for Elijah. He had retreated to a cave. I can imagine what the people who had to listen to it must have thought. And maybe it was exhausting for God too. Sitting alone in his cave, battle scared and road weary, Elijah wonders why God is nowhere to be found. And just then, the voice of God appears saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And this is a bemused sort of question, the puzzlement of which you can hear even more if we were to read the King James Version, where God says, "What dost thou hear, Elijah?" as if this was Gertrude talking to Hamlet. And another way I imagine this scene is by picturing Elijah sitting alone in his cave, stewing over his own zealousness, when the voice of God comes over the loudspeaker saying, "Pity, party of one." To which Elijah launches into a litany of all that he has done and how he is so alone. And I have a hard time listening to this without wanting to respond, "What are you talking about, Elijah? Didn't God just speak to you?" Maybe God was equally confused by Elijah's petulance. Maybe that's why God tells him to go out onto the mountaintop, for the Lord is soon approaching. So out Elijah goes, probably expecting or at least hoping for a big, showy, boisterous revelation of God. And sure enough, there was a great wind, and Elijah leaned in, but God wasn't there. And then there was an earthquake, and eager Elijah looked, but God was not there. But then there was a fire. And excited Elijah looked, but God was not in that fire. God was nowhere, Elijah must have thought. I am still all alone. And as expectant Elijah stood on that mountaintop, a new sound came. A sound not usually associated with power and might, not with God then, not with presidents now. For there on that mountain, Elijah was surrounded by the sound of sheer silence. And how much more powerful was that silence than all the bombast that had come before? Listening to that sound of sheer silence, Elijah realizes he's in the presence of the Almighty. And he goes out to stand and to face to face with Holy Wisdom herself. And for a second time, God asks, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" But the incredulity is gone. In its place is care and compassion for where Elijah really is. It's as if in that silence, it wasn't only Elijah who learned how to listen more carefully. God did too. Out of that silence, a still, small voice emerged. And it brought God and Elijah closer together. Do you know the sound of freshly fallen snow? Of the sheer silence that occurs when moonlight is reflected in the crystals of snowflakes? Of the crackle that forms atop banks and drifts when the moisture is just right? Do you know the sound of stars in the desert sky, of the movement of constellations and the long shadows cast by boulders and cliffs? What about the sound of a freshly drawn bath, of the steam that rises and the smell of salts as you slip your body in. Do you know the sound of children sleeping? Or daffodils blooming? Do you know the sound of a loved one dying? Do you know these sounds of sheer silence? Writing in First Matters this week, Clerk of Session Larry Tallamy writes about the importance of solitude and how he's learning this practice in retirement. Larry writes of following Thoreau's advice and of listening to the moments when there are no planes or boats, of listening to the in-between spaces of forests and life without blackberries or cell phones. This is hard work, Larry shares, work that is important but ongoing and ever-evolving. Maybe Larry was reading the same scriptures that I was reading this week. For Jesus, too, knew the power of solitude. In our gospel text this morning, Jesus leaves the disciples and the crowds to go up to the mountain by himself. He went up to pray and presumably to rest after a long day of ministry and preaching, to say nothing of the more than 5,000 people he had just fed. He went to the mountain alone. This is a point especially emphasized in Matthew's telling of the story. Jesus goes alone by himself to be with himself in solitude and in silence. He goes to listen. While Jesus is alone on that mountaintop, the disciples have boarded their boat, and the boat has drifted further and farther away from the shore, battered by the waves and blown by the wind. And when Jesus returns early in the morning, he walks across the sea to rejoin his friends on the boat. Now, the miracle of Jesus walking on water comes soon after the miracle of the feeding of the more than 5,000. And together, this miracle double play occurs in 3 out of the 4 Gospels. It comes sequentially in Mark, Matthew, and John. And maybe you're asking, why not all 4? Well, and that's a story for another day. But let me just tell you in short that what happens in Luke is that Luke substitutes the miracle of Jesus walking on water, which is an action identifying Jesus as God, in favor of a conversation between Jesus and the disciples that reaches the same conclusion. In other words, these miracles of feeding and walking on water, or even of feeding and then of identity talk, are important. They say something to us about God, the presence of God, and God's care for us. Now, as we know, each of the gospel accounts are written with slightly different aims and for very different audiences. Thus, the accounting of the same story often has different details and indeed sometimes entire reworkings based on who's telling it. To wit, the Gospel of Matthew that we heard this morning is the only gospel that reports Peter's walking on water. In the earlier Markan account and in the later Johannine version, Jesus walks across the water and gets into the boat with his disciples. It is only here in Matthew that Jesus calls to Peter to get out of the boat and to come to him. Like Elijah responding to God's call to come out and see God on a mountaintop, Peter responds to Jesus' call to come out and see him on the water. And just as God wasn't in the wind for Elijah, Peter too becomes frightened when he's focused on the storm's winds rather than on the presence of God before him. And just as Elijah discovered God in an unexpected silence, Peter reunites with Jesus in an unexpected place. Jesus, who was elsewhere during the night, is now here with Peter. God, who was nowhere in a fire, an earthquake, or a wind, is now here with Elijah, and indeed with us. Now, my friend and I have talked since our luncheon earlier this week. I actually spoke to her this morning to get consent for sharing our story with you, and we talked about how important we are in one another's lives. This week, we both found voices within, and we made time to listen to one another's hearts. What has always been present, namely our love and our commitment to one another, remains true. so too does the fact that my absence was hurtful. It hurts when people are nowhere to be found when we need them. I know this, I've felt this loss. And I know too that I've caused such loss, and that I've let people I care deeply about, down. The work of balancing relationships and solitude is tricky. Every couple knows this, and today's scriptures gives us two examples. We hear the story of Elijah wondering about where God is and how it is that he can feel so alone. Then we hear the story of a beloved disciple wondering if it is really God he sees out on the water. And if it is, how can he go out to meet Jesus? In these stories, we hear about absence and presence. We hear about how hard this balance can be to get right. Now, these actions of going away and coming back, these can be big things, things probably left best to God, death and resurrection, for example. Or they can be small things we humans can practice. Taking retreat to nourish our souls, having difficult conversations with people we love when things need to be said, putting away our phones and stepping away from work or visiting a friend we haven't seen in too long. Perhaps it's in these little moments of going away and coming back, of rupture and repair, of forgiveness and sin, of absence and return, that are what strengthen all of our relationships. For it's the in-between spaces where God does God's work. In these spaces, maybe we will hear new sounds calling us to new wonders. Put another way, maybe these are the sort of daily miracles our faith gives us the language to proclaim. The little things that we can resurrect in our own lives. Things like listening to hurt, or of dusting off a few old dreams, or reconnecting with a friend from the past. When it comes to God and the godly things we seek, maybe the space between nowhere and now here is closer than we think.